Penguin Random House Audio presents The Book That Changed America, How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation, by Randall Fuller. Read for you by Stefan Rudnicki. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief, it was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light, it was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. Charles Dickens, A Tale of Two Cities, 1859. Whenever a true theory appears, it will be its own evidence. Its test is that it will explain all phenomena. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Nature, 1836. Preface. The Civil War shattered and remade America, destroying the slave culture of the South and killing 720,000 men. It also temporarily obscured an event that was nearly as seminal, the publication of Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species. Like the first mortar shell to land on Fort Sumter, Darwin's book would produce epochal change and unanticipated aftershocks. It would crash and rumble in expanding circles throughout the nation, disrupting old habits and beliefs, altering cherished ways of thinking, and remaking society. Ultimately, the book would do to American intellectual life what the war did to its political, economic, and social spheres, blast it to pieces, and then reconsolidate it in new ways. One copy of The Origin made a disproportionately large impact on American culture. That copy, which today resides at Harvard University, was sent by its author to Asa Gray, a botanist who soon championed the new theory to general and scientific audiences throughout America. Gray passed his heavily annotated book to Charles Loring Brace, a social reformer who seized on the work as a powerful argument against slavery. Brace then introduced the same copy to three remarkable thinkers: Franklin Sanborn, a key supporter of the abolitionist John Brown; Bronson Alcott, the erstwhile philosopher and father of Louisa May; and Henry David Thoreau, who used Darwin's theory to redirect his life's work. Today we think of Darwin's theory of evolution as the spark that ignited the battle between science and religion. But that notion overlooks the way Darwin's first American readers encountered it. Anti-slavery activists eagerly embraced The Origin of Species because they believed the book advanced the cause of abolition. By hinting that all humans were biologically related, Darwin's work seemed to refute once and for all the idea that African American slaves were a separate, inferior species. In the immediate aftermath of the John Brown affair, which all five of these early American readers of Darwin supported, evolutionary ideas were seen as powerful ammunition in the debate over slavery. Only after they had employed Darwin's theory of natural selection on behalf of abolitionism did these five thinkers come to discover that it also posed enormous threats to their other beliefs, including their faith in God and their trust that America was a country divinely chosen for the regeneration of the world. This book is a biography of the single most important idea of the 19th century. It is also an account of issues and concerns that are still very much with us, including racism, one of the most intractable problems in American life, and the enduring conflict between science and religion. Ultimately, it is shaped by a notion of its own, that ideas are like the plants and animals in Darwin's theory of natural selection, shaped by their particular context, thriving or dying as a result of their ability to adapt. This process can be wrenching. It leaves people trapped between two ways of thinking and believing, stranded between two existences. But it also remakes the world. Part 1. Origins. Chapter 1. The Book from Across the Atlantic. The house on Sudbury Road belonged to Franklin Benjamin Sanborn, the schoolmaster of a small private academy in Concord, Massachusetts. It was sizable, but then so was Sanborn, so tall and lanky that a Concord farmer once referred to his legs as God Almighty's tongs when he strode across the stage in a melodrama written by the young Louisa May Alcott. At 6'4", Sanborn hulked and towered and loomed. Yet he often felt small and insignificant, a dwarf among the intellectual giants of a previous generation. He had been born too late to participate in the intellectual revolution of the 1830s, when Emerson and Thoreau and some half a dozen others had founded transcendentalism to protest the rampant materialism of American life. To compensate for his sense of belatedness, Sanborn rebelled. At age 28, his habitual stance toward life was that of opposition to whatever and whomsoever were for the time being in the ascendant in public affairs. He flouted tradition, courted controversy. Recently, this had gotten him into trouble. For the past 2 months, he had lived in constant icy terror that he would be arrested and tried for treason, a crime punishable by death. Only through great force of will had he overcome his dread long enough to host this evening's dinner party. Sanborn's guest of honor was Charles Loring Brace, a member of an old, well-connected family from Connecticut. Among Brace's numerous far-flung cousins was the novelist Harriet Beecher Stowe, whose remarkable best-selling first novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, had been published in 1852, 1 year before Brace himself embarked on the single greatest creative act of his life, founding the Children's Aid Society. Brace established a newsboys' lodging house to provide safe accommodations for the filthy army of homeless boys who sold newspapers throughout the city. In 1854, he began the program for which he is still remembered. Known colloquially as the Orphan Trains, his emigration plan transported thousands of abandoned, orphaned, and runaway children to rural areas in the West, where it was believed that healthful surroundings and stable families would transform their lives. Brace was in Concord on this New Year's Day because he had been invited by one of Sanborn's closest friends and allies, Amos Bronson Alcott, the local school superintendent, to deliver a lecture. Alcott's face resembled a rumpled pillowcase. His eyes were watery blue, he was 60 years old, and he liked to walk with a gold-headed cane that had been presented to him by a coterie of young admirers in St. Louis, who believed he was the most radical idealist in America. It was true. Alcott considered ideas more real than the physical world. He believed that things, trees, apples, rivers, and swales, were little more than a wan facsimile of higher ideals. This notion went a long way toward explaining his legendary improvidence. He once embarked on a 3-month lecture tour and returned with $1. Another time, as a young man, he spent an entire winter peddling Yankee wares to rich southern planters, sleeping in slave quarters and borrowing books from his host's oak-paneled libraries, only to squander every cent he had earned on a new suit. His life would surely have been one of even greater indigence had he not married Abigail May, known as Abba, and eventually immortalized as Marmee in their daughter's most famous and beloved book, Little Women. While Alcott conversed and dined in Sanborn's warm parlor this evening, Abba remained at home, toiling to keep their threadbare household together. The last person at Sanborn's dinner party cared little for New York City or its burgeoning population of orphans. In Walden, or Life in the Woods, published 5 years earlier, he complained that his fellow citizens routinely asked him what portion of my income I devoted to charitable purposes, and how many poor children I maintained. Henry David Thoreau resented these questions. They presumed a position of moral superiority, a small-town hauteur, and they missed the central point, which was that he had found a subject far more interesting than those in need, himself. "I should not talk so much about myself," he joked, "if there were anybody else whom I knew as well. Unfortunately, I am confined to this theme by the narrowness of my experience." Thoreau came to Sanborn's house that night not to learn about the Children's Aid Society or the immigrant population that made such charities necessary. He came because he had nothing better to do, because it was the first day of 1860,
Sample complete. Ready to continue?